I used to think I knew what love was, until he made me forget who I was. He never raised his voice, never hit me. He didn't have to. With every compliment that cut, every lie whispered like a lullaby, he rewrote my reality. I stopped laughing. I stopped remembering. I stopped existing. Until I found the phones, the recordings, the truth he hid in the basement. And that's when I knew. I wasn't crazy. I was being erased. But not anymore. He thought I'd always dance to the pull of his strings. He didn't know I was learning how to pull them back. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Puppet on a Chain. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, Silken Threads. I used to think I knew what love felt like. That familiar flutter in your chest, the ache of longing when they're gone, the warmth of being seen and wanted. But love, real love, or what I thought was real, doesn't feel like a thousand invisible threads winding themselves around your body while you sleep. It doesn't whisper sweet promises while weaving a net so delicate you mistake it for safety. But that's how it started. With him, Elias. I met him on a rainy Tuesday, the kind of gray that soaks into your bones and makes your soul hum with sadness. I remember it vividly, not just the weather, but the exact taste of that moment. I had spilled coffee on my thesis notes, and my bus drove straight past me as I screamed and waved like a maniac. My backpack strap broke, and I was seconds from bursting into tears when I heard a voice behind me say, "Rough day?" I turned and there he was. Dry, calm, impossibly composed. His umbrella was black, classic, and large enough for two. I didn't know it yet, but he had already taken the first string and tied it around my wrist. "I could say the same," I replied, laughing awkwardly. "But I think the universe's vendetta is solely aimed at me today." He smiled, that kind of smile that feels like it's just for you, like it's being sculpted in real time from some hidden place that only opens when you're around. "Well then," he said, stepping closer and angling the umbrella over me, "I'll consider it my civic duty to rebalance the scales." He offered to walk me home. I hesitated for all of 3 seconds, then nodded. Because I was wet and cold and tired. Because his voice was smooth and his presence soothing. Because I didn't see the threads, not yet. That first walk was effortless. The way we spoke, it was like we'd known each other in another life. He was smart, but not arrogant. Funny, but in a quiet way that made you lean in. He asked about my major, what I was writing about, how I liked the city. But he didn't overshare. He gave me just enough to be mysterious. Just enough to make me want to see him again. And I did. Over and over. In coffee shops and bookstores and parks with peeling benches. Sometimes he brought me poems he said reminded him of me. Other times he just sat beside me, close but not touching, and listened. Really listened. I had never met a man who paid such laser-focused attention to every word I said. Who seemed to remember every offhand comment I made, and bring it up later like it mattered. Looking back, I wonder if he was taking inventory. Studying the architecture of my mind, so he could rearrange the walls later. Weeks passed. Then months. Before I realized it, we were us. He never asked me to be his. He just was. In my space. In my phone. In my thoughts. My world started to bend around him without me noticing. It felt natural. It felt right. But it wasn't long before I noticed the subtle tug of the threads tightening. It started with my laugh. "Your laugh is cute," he said one night, lying beside me as the city glowed through the curtains. "But you laugh too loud. People notice." I laughed in response, too loud apparently, and he flinched. "Just saying," he muttered. "You're more elegant when you're quieter." It seemed small, innocent, maybe even a compliment, but I stopped laughing as freely after that. Then came my clothes. "You look beautiful," he'd say, "but you don't need to wear makeup. You're naturally stunning." I started leaving my lipstick behind, then my eyeliner. He told me red made me look harsh. That certain dresses were too much. That he liked me simple. So I simplified. I wanted to be the version of me he loved best. Didn't every girl? And that's the most dangerous part. When you want to be controlled. When the manipulation doesn't feel like chains, it feels like devotion. I didn't realize what was happening because it didn't come with red flags. It came with roses. It came with compliments. With long, lingering kisses. With murmured, "I miss you," s and gentle hands on my back as I drifted to sleep. But the thing about threads is that you don't feel them until you try to move. One night, I mentioned going out with my best friend, Kara. His smile thinned. "Oh," he said. "Again." I blinked. "Yeah, It's her birthday. You've seen her a lot lately, haven't you? I froze. She's my best friend. I know, he said, kissing my temple. I just miss you when you're not around. But go. Have fun. I went. But I spent the entire dinner thinking about the way he had said again. I replayed it in my mind like a scratched record. I wondered if I was seeing her too much. I felt guilty. That's how the strings started wrapping tighter. I didn't pull away. I pulled in. Because Elias was good to me. He was always there. Always generous. Always attentive. He helped me revise my thesis. He cooked me dinner. He fixed things I didn't know were broken. And he made me feel loved. So when he said Kara didn't seem like a real friend, when he pointed out how she never really asked about him, or how she always seemed to want me to herself, I listened. I believed him. I didn't even realize I had stopped calling her until her last message read, "Are you okay? Did I do something?" I stared at it for a long time and never replied, because by then I had become something else. A little quieter. A little softer. A little more confused. But still convinced I was in control. And Elias. He was the anchor. The only one who understood me. Who really understood me. Who told me I was too much for most people, but just enough for him. I believed him. Every word. Every warning. Every seed he planted. He never yelled. He never threatened. He didn't have to. He just waited. Waited while I trimmed off pieces of myself to better fit his hands. While I second-guessed my instincts and deleted old photos of nights he said made me look messy. While I learned to silence my thoughts if they didn't align with his tone. That's the thing about being a puppet. You don't know you're on a stage until the curtains fall. But that wouldn't happen for a long time. For now, I was still dancing, twirling gently in the air, light as silk, unaware of the chain being coiled beneath my feet. And Elias? He was watching, smiling, pulling every string. Chapter 2, The Mirror Lies. It's strange how you can look at your own reflection and not recognize what you see. I don't mean in a poetic, I've changed kind of way. I mean literally. You stare at your own eyes and wonder if they've always looked that empty. You tilt your head and wonder if your face always looked that unsure. There was a time I stood in front of the mirror and posed with purpose, smirking like I had secrets. I used to love my reflection. I trusted it. Now it looked like someone else lived inside my skin. I don't remember when exactly the disconnect began, but I know Elias was there, close behind me, when I first started to doubt what I saw. It was small things at first. They always are. The subtle rearranging of thoughts. The passing comments that linger in your head like smoke, thin and toxic. "You overthink everything," he told me once, watching me pick out an outfit for his company dinner. "Just wear something neutral. You always get so anxious about the simplest things." I looked down at the two dresses in my hands. Neither of them screamed anxiety. But I put them both back. Because he was right, wasn't he? I mean, I was always in my head. Always spinning with second guesses. I laughed too loud. I needed too much reassurance. I wasn't like the women he worked with, those smooth, polished types who wore quiet colors and talked in careful tones. Women who never stumbled over their words or laughed with their whole chest. "I just want you to be your best self," he'd add, slipping behind me and wrapping his arms around my waist. Not the chaotic version. I smiled. I nodded. I wore the gray dress that made me feel invisible. That night, I stood beside him like a shadow. I barely spoke unless spoken to. I watched his co-workers with their perfect white teeth and wine glasses dangling like accessories. Elias beamed at them all, effortless, magnetic, admired. When he looked at me, his smile softened into something more private, but colder somehow. Like he was performing a role I couldn't quite see. "Blossom doesn't really like big events," he said once when I excused myself to go to the bathroom. "She gets overwhelmed. Sensitive soul." When I came back, they all looked at me with pity. And I smiled because I didn't know what else to do. When we got home that night, I cried. Not loudly. Not in a way that was messy or hard to witness. Just quiet tears, alone in the bathroom while I brushed off mascara and shame. Elias tapped on the door lightly, not unkindly. "You okay?" "Yeah," I whispered. "I just don't want people to misinterpret you," he said through the door. "You're complex. And not everyone gets that. I'm trying to help." I nodded like he could see me. The next morning, he brought me tea and told me I looked beautiful even without trying. Then he reminded me to maybe skip the brunch with my old roommate next week. "You always say she makes you feel guilty for moving on." I didn't remember ever saying that. But who was I to argue? I canceled brunch. And soon, I stopped making plans altogether. I told myself I was too busy. That my friends were distant, preoccupied, or judgmental. Elias said it was good to keep my circle small anyway, that most people were fake, and we were better without all that noise. It felt like peace at first, until I started talking to myself, whispering questions under my breath, just to hear a voice that wasn't his. Did I really say that? Was that how it happened? Am I blowing things out of proportion again? The mirror didn't help. She lied too. She told me my hair looked fine when Elias said it was frizzy. She told me my outfit was cute when he said it looked immature. She told me I wasn't crazy when he asked if I'd forgotten to take my iron pills again. You're just foggy sometimes, babe. I began to hate that version of myself. The version that pushed back. That raised an eyebrow. That wondered if maybe, just maybe, he was wrong. Because questioning him meant something terrifying. That I could no longer trust the person I'd built my world around. And when you take the centerpiece out of a house of cards, it all collapses. So I stayed quiet. Still, grateful even. And he kept polishing me. That's what it felt like at times. Like I was being buffed down into something smoother. Shinier. Easier to hold. I started timing how I said things, predicting how he'd react. I avoided topics I used to love, like dreams, books, and politics, because Elias had opinions about those. You get too fired up, he'd say. It's not a good look. Eventually, I became a gallery of curated behaviors. A self I wore like a costume. I smiled on cue. I spoke less. I leaned on him for validation, because I had forgotten what my own voice sounded like. And somewhere in all of this, the mirror stopped being a comfort. It started to scare me. Because the girl inside it didn't blink like I did. She stared too long. Her expression twitched at the edges, like she wanted to scream. She was the version of me that remembered what confidence felt like. The version that used to dance barefoot in the kitchen and laugh until her stomach ached. I began avoiding her. I would brush my teeth in the dark, apply lotion with my back turned. I stopped wearing lipstick altogether. I told myself it was because Elias liked me natural, but deep down, I knew it was because I couldn't bear to see my reflection ask, "Who are you becoming?" I think the most tragic part was how normal it all felt. That's the brilliance of it, really. Manipulation doesn't arrive with sirens. It comes like fog, slow and soft, muffling your instincts, making everything feel distant. You don't notice what you've lost until someone hands you a memory you'd forgotten existed. Like the time I found my old journal while cleaning the closet. It was shoved behind a box of winter coats I never wore anymore. Covered in dust. I flipped it open and read an entry from the year before I met Elias. "I feel unstoppable today," I had written. "I love who I'm becoming." My hands trembled as I read it again, because I couldn't remember the last time I felt that way. I closed the journal and stuffed it back where I found it. I told myself it was normal to evolve, that maybe I had just matured, settled down, found someone who loved me enough to point out my blind spots. But that night, as I crawled into bed and Elias curled himself around me like always, I stared at the ceiling and whispered a question I hadn't dared ask in months. "Am I still me?" His hand brushed my shoulder. "What was that?" "Nothing," I said quickly. "Just thinking." "You always think too much," he murmured, kissing my neck. "That's your problem." And just like that, the thread pulled tighter. And I stopped thinking again. Chapter 3, Pinned Wings. There's a moment when a butterfly lands in your palm, so fragile, so weightless, you barely feel it. You hold your breath. You stay still. You don't dare move because you don't want to scare it off. You want it to trust you. You want to believe it chose you. But the second you close your fingers, even gently, even lovingly, it stops being a butterfly. That's what I became. A delicate thing. Pretty manageable. A thing to be kept, admired, and tucked away. Not for freedom. Not for flight. Just stillness. Silence. Obedience. I used to tell myself I was lucky. That Elias chose me out of everyone. That he wanted to build something serious, meaningful. He didn't play games like other guys. He didn't cheat or disappear. He didn't party or flirt or lie. He was reliable. Devoted. So when he started asking for more of my time, more of my attention, more of my choices, I gave it willingly. Gratefully. Even when it cost me everything. It started with school. "You're burning out," he said one night as I hunched over my laptop, neck stiff, fingers cramping from typing the same paragraph a dozen different ways. "This program is eating you alive. You never sleep anymore. You're not yourself." "I just have to push through this semester," I mumbled, not looking up. "It's almost over." He sat down beside me, so quiet I could barely hear his breath. His hand slid over mine, gently prying my fingers from the keyboard. "Blossom," he said softly. "What's more important? Some grade on some paper, or your health?" I didn't answer, because the truth was I was exhausted, tired of trying so hard to prove I was worthy, tired of the weight of expectations I had once willingly carried like armor. Elias looked at me like I was already enough, like I didn't have to do anything more. He told me I didn't have to fight anymore. Just fall. Just rest. Just let go. So I deferred the semester. Just one, I told myself. Just a pause. A breather. To reset. But the pause never ended. The silence of not going to class was louder than I expected. My routine unraveled. My world shrank to the walls of Elias's apartment, where I stayed more often now. Where everything was always clean, calm, quiet. Where I didn't have to perform or prove or think too hard. He worked from home mostly, always on his laptop, always in some important call with people whose names I didn't know. He was patient when I hovered, gentle when I asked questions. But over time, he started closing his laptop when I walked into the room. He started speaking in lower tones. He started saying things like, "I just need a little space, babe. Nothing personal." So I stayed in the bedroom more, sometimes for hours. He brought me meals, kissed my forehead, told me to relax. "You deserve a man who takes care of you," he'd say, stroking my hair as I lay curled against him. "Not one who makes you carry the weight of the world on your back." It sounded like love. It felt like captivity. I didn't see it that way yet. Not then. But I did notice how I began asking permission to do things I used to do freely. "Can I go to the library today? Do you mind if I call my sister? Would it be okay if I stepped out for a walk?" He never said no. He didn't have to. He'd just sigh sometimes. Or frown. Or tilt his head with that look. The one that said, "Really? After everything I've done for you?" So I stayed home. I scrolled through social media with growing detachment, seeing lives that looked too loud, too bright. My friends had stopped tagging me in anything. Kara had unfollowed me altogether. My mother's texts went unread, unopened. I told myself it was because I didn't want their noise, their drama, their judgment. But really, I didn't know how to explain where I'd gone. Because I was still here, wasn't I? Wasn't I? Sometimes I would stand at the window, watching people rush by with purpose. Their coats flapping, their arms swinging, laughter escaping their mouths in clouds of breath. And I'd feel it. The ache. The unbearable ache of remembering what it felt like to move freely. To speak without checking his eyes first. To exist without waiting for approval. But then Elias would appear behind me, wrapping his arms around my waist like a weighted blanket. "You thinking too much again?" he'd murmur against my neck. And I'd nod. Because it was easier than explaining that I wasn't sure who I was anymore. He started managing more things for me. My bank account. My emails. My schedule. He said I was too forgetful, too distracted. He'd take my phone sometimes to keep me off it, and return it hours later with a smile. "You'll thank me one day." And I did. Because I didn't know how to survive without him anymore. He made the world feel safe. Predictable. Structured. Even if it was a structure I hadn't built. Even if it was a cage with velvet bars. The days began to blur together. I forgot what day it was. I stopped setting alarms. I stopped brushing my hair some mornings. I lost track of time, of thought, of myself. But Elias never wavered. He was always there. Patient. Calm. Watchful. He never yelled. Never raised a hand. Never called me names. But he did something worse. He made me believe I was the broken one. That he was the only reason I was holding it together. "Without me," he said once, cradling my face in both hands, "you'd fall apart, wouldn't you?" I nodded, because he was right. I had fallen apart, and he had swept me up piece by piece, gluing me back into something smaller, something safer, something he could manage. I wasn't sure if I loved him anymore. I wasn't sure if I ever had, but I needed him, not like a partner, like a crutch, like oxygen. That's what manipulation does. It makes you mistake dependence for devotion. It pins your wings and calls it protection. And when you finally try to fly again, you forget how. One night I had a dream. I was in a glass box. Clear on all sides. I could see the world, sunlight, music, color. But I couldn't touch it. I banged on the walls, but no one heard me. No one looked. And Elias? He sat outside, smiling. Hands folded. Watching. When I woke up, I was crying. Elias stirred beside me, half asleep. "Nightmare?" I didn't answer. Because I didn't know how to tell him he was the nightmare. And I was too afraid to admit it out loud. Not because I feared him hurting me, but because I feared losing the only person who still held the map to my mind, even if he was the one who'd erased all the roads. Chapter 4, The Disappearing Self. I used to think memory was sacred, that even if everything else was taken from me, my body, my time, my choices, I'd still have the truth of what I lived through etched somewhere deep beneath my skin. But I was wrong. Memories don't scream when they're rewritten. They whisper. They shift. They dissolve. Not all at once, but slowly, like fog swallowing a familiar road until you can't remember where you were going, or if you were ever on the road at all. I was losing myself. Quietly. Thoroughly. Without bruises or battle scars to show for it. And the worst part, I thought I was healing. Elias told me I was. "You're getting better," he'd say, tucking a blanket around my legs, handing me tea, smoothing my hair. "You're not as anxious as you used to be. You're calmer, softer, more at peace." But what he called peace was really paralysis. And what he praised as progress was really silence. I'd stopped asking questions, stopped pushing back, stopped wondering why I no longer laughed or dreamt or wanted. All that remained of me was the version of Blossom he preferred, tamed, dulled, easily shaped. Still, there were moments, sharp, intrusive flashes, when the real me tried to surface. Like when I swore I remembered texting Kara that day. I had typed out the message. I remembered the blue bubble on the screen. I had said, "I miss you. Let's talk soon. Please." But when I went to find it later, it wasn't there. No sent messages. No drafts. Nothing. "Maybe you dreamed it," Elias said without looking up from his laptop. "You've been sleepwalking again. Remember?" "No," I said. "I haven't sleepwalked in years." He raised an eyebrow. "You don't remember last week? You were in the kitchen at 3 a.m., talking to the refrigerator." I stared at him. "What?" He laughed gently. "You scared the hell out of me. You opened the freezer and started asking it where your passport was." I blinked. My mouth opened. Closed. "That didn't happen." "Babe, yes it did. You just don't remember. You were half asleep." He said it with such confidence, such casual familiarity, that I felt the ground shift beneath me. I walked out of the room without saying anything. I locked the bathroom door and sat on the floor, knees to my chest, trying to breathe. I searched my mind for that night, for any shred of truth. But it was like trying to grip smoke. What if I had done it? What if I was losing time? What if I was actually sick? I had Googled dissociation. I had read about early signs of memory loss. But nothing fit. Nothing explained the growing hollowness inside me. Nothing could account for the way my days felt staged, like I was acting out a script someone else had written for me. Sometimes I'd look at Elias while he slept and wonder how much of me he had erased. What stories he had swapped out, what moments he had altered. He was so sure of things. So precise. He remembered details I didn't. He quoted conversations I didn't recall. He told me things I'd done that I would have sworn never happened. And when I pushed back, he looked at me like I was fragile. Delicate. Mentally slipping. "Are you sure you're okay, Blossom?" he'd ask, his tone gentle. "You've been scattered lately. I'm worried." So I stopped pushing back. Because if he was right, if I was truly unraveling, then maybe he was the only thing tethering me to reality. And if he was wrong, if he was lying, that was a truth too terrifying to hold. One night, I woke to find him watching me. I don't know how long he'd been there, standing at the edge of the bed, half in shadow, his arms crossed loosely like he was just observing. I startled. "What are you doing?" He didn't flinch. "You were talking in your sleep." "So, you said someone's name. A man's name." I frowned. "What? No, I didn't." "Yeah, you said, 'Don't tell him, Leo. Please.'" My blood ran cold. "I don't know anyone named Leo." He sat down beside me, eyes dark and unreadable. "Are you hiding something from me?" "No. Of course not." He leaned in, his voice low and quiet. "Then why do you keep saying things you can't remember? Why do you keep doing things you can't explain?" "I'm not." "Are you seeing someone?" The question hit me like a slap. My stomach churned. "Elias." "No. I don't even leave the apartment anymore." "Exactly," he whispered. "And still, these things keep happening." I felt something shatter in me. Because even though I knew I wasn't cheating, even though I knew the name Leo meant nothing to me, I couldn't trust my own mind enough to fight him. I sat there, stunned, helpless, as he kissed my forehead. "I'm not mad. I just want you to be honest with me. We can get through anything, if you tell me the truth." But what if I no longer knew what was true? That night, I stared at the ceiling for hours, wondering if maybe I'd finally crossed some invisible threshold. If I was becoming what he kept warning me about. Delusional. Paranoid. Unwell. My journal didn't help. Because when I flipped to an older page where I'd written, "March 8th, dinner with Kara, finally laughed again," it was scratched out. Rewritten in different handwriting. Neater. Not mine. It now read, March 8th anxiety attack. Stayed home. Cried again. I stared at it for a long time. And that's when I knew. He was rewriting me. Page by page. Thought by thought. And I had let him. There's a terror that lives beneath the skin when you realize you've been edited. When you realize someone else holds the pen to your life, and they've been quietly crossing out your memories with red ink and replacing them with things that make you feel small. But I wasn't ready to leave. Not yet. Because leaving would mean facing a world where I didn't know what was real. It would mean admitting I had spent months loving someone who had been erasing me the entire time. And I wasn't strong enough for that yet. So I did what I always did. I smiled. I stayed. I told him I loved him. And in the mirror, I watched a stranger mouth the words back. The real me? She was somewhere deep beneath the surface. Buried. Bound. Silent. But not gone. Not completely. I could feel her sometimes. Like a tremor in the foundation. A whisper behind the lies. And one day, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but one day, I knew she would scream loud enough to wake me. Even if it shattered everything. Even if I didn't survive it. Chapter 5, Splinters in the String. You don't realize how quiet your world has become until something makes a sound. It doesn't even have to be loud. Just the right sound at the right moment. A drawer creaking open, a whisper where there should be silence, a vibration against hardwood when you know your phone is powered off, and suddenly, the quiet you thought was comforting becomes suspicious. Like a lull before something breaks. That's what it felt like. The splinters didn't arrive like explosions. They didn't shatter my world in a single cinematic moment. They arrived like hairline cracks in glass. Tiny. Invisible to the untrained eye. But if you looked closely enough, you could trace them. And I had started looking. It began with the keys. There was a small dish by the front door where Elias kept his spare keys. Always two sets, his car key and the key to the apartment. He was meticulous about them. Lined up neatly, like everything else in his world. But one night, when I was home alone and restless, I walked past the dish and noticed something off. Three keys. Not two. One of them was unfamiliar, smaller, older looking, with no label. I picked it up, turning it over in my palm. It didn't belong to his car. It didn't match the apartment doors. I tried the hallway closet just to check, but nothing. I stared at it, and for a second, I felt something flicker inside me. A memory? A feeling? I couldn't place it. Just this strange, hollow tug. Like my mind almost knew where it came from, but stopped short. When Elias got home that night, I asked. Oh, he said casually. That's for the storage unit in the basement. I forgot to throw it out. We don't use it anymore. He kissed my forehead and walked past me. But my stomach twisted. Because we'd never had a storage unit. I'd been in the basement before. There were lockers, sure, but all of them were locked with codes or combination locks. And more importantly, he had told me months ago that he didn't trust storing things down there. Mold, he'd said. Water damage. I've never kept a thing in that dungeon. I remembered him joking. But now we had a key. I should have let it go. Should have dropped it back in the dish and walked away. That's what the old version of me would have done. The quiet, grateful version. But something inside me, something small, stubborn, and still alive, wouldn't let it go. So the next morning, while he was out at a meeting, I took the key. My hands shook the entire elevator ride down. My heart pounded like it wanted to warn me, don't. Don't pull the thread. Don't find out. But I needed to know. The basement was cold and damp, just like I remembered. Fluorescent lights buzzed above, flickering like dying fireflies. I walked down the row of storage units slowly, fingers tracing the metal mesh until I found one with a lock. I tried the key. It fit. My breath caught. I turned it, and the door creaked open. Inside, it was dark. Dust-covered boxes stacked haphazardly. A coat draped over a chair. Some tools. Nothing overtly sinister, at first glance. But then I saw a small box labeled miscellaneous, tech. I pulled it down, sat on the concrete floor, and opened it. Inside were old phones. Three of them. Scratched. Slightly damaged. Each with a different colored case. One of them was mine. My old phone. The one I'd lost 6 months ago, and replaced without thinking twice. I dropped it in the kitchen sink, or so I believed. But here it was. Dry. Intact. I powered it on. Battery low. But still working. I opened my photos. My texts. And my heart dropped. There were screenshots of my conversations with Kara, long messages I didn't remember writing, drafts of apologies, deleted threads, things I was sure had vanished, wiped clean, erased by time and confusion. But they were here. Evidence. and then I saw the recording, a saved audio file labeled simply, 3 a.m. confession. I clicked play. It was me, my voice, raspy, tired. I don't know what's happening, I whispered in the recording. He tells me things and I believe them, even when I feel like something's wrong. I think he's lying to me. I think he's making me forget things. My breath hitched in the recording. I could hear it. I'm scared, I whispered. I don't know who I am anymore. I dropped the phone like it burned me. My whole body went cold. I had recorded myself. I had known. At some point, some desperate, lucid version of me had tried to hold on to the truth. Had left a trail, breadcrumbs, hoping I'd come back for them. But then I hadn't. Because something, someone had made me forget. I packed the phones in my bag and left the basement like a thief. I didn't know what to do. Where to go? Who to trust? All I knew was that my mind, my memories, had been tampered with. It wasn't just manipulation anymore. It was war. But I didn't confront him right away. Because I knew better now. Elias was too smooth. Too controlled. If I made one wrong move, he'd twist it. Make me doubt it all over again. Make me believe I had hallucinated the entire storage unit. So I waited. Watched. Took notes. I kept the phones hidden. I stopped speaking my thoughts aloud. I journaled only in my head, writing entries in invisible ink across my thoughts. And I began to see more cracks. Like how the Wi-Fi would go out every time I tried to FaceTime someone. How he'd intercept packages before I could check the mail. How the one friend who did manage to reach me by email mysteriously stopped replying after I mentioned I'd found something strange. I began to see it all. The network of control. The surveillance. The curation of my reality. I wasn't just being gaslit, I was being archived. Edited like a file. And he had been doing it for longer than I realized. But here's the thing about puppets. Even the most delicate ones can learn to bite the hand that pulls their strings. And now I had teeth. Chapter 6, The Marionette Awakens. There's a stillness in rebellion that no one talks about. It's not always loud. It doesn't begin with screams or shattered glass, or some dramatic escape in the middle of the night. Sometimes it's just the moment you stop asking for permission. The second you let your silence harden into strategy. The exact breath where obedience ends and observation begins. That's where I live now. In that still, dangerous place. A marionette no longer dancing, but watching. Waiting. Planning. The thing about being controlled for so long is that you start to know your captor better than they know themselves. You learn the rhythm of their voice. The subtle shifts in their mood. The way their eyes dart when they're lying, or the specific angle they tilt their head when they're preparing to make you feel small. I knew Elias better than I had ever known anyone. And now, I used that knowledge to begin my undoing, his undoing. Silently. It started with the phones. The ones I'd hidden after finding them in the basement. I charged them during the hours Elias was at meetings or on calls in the other room. I stayed quiet. I feigned drowsiness. I played the part of the delicate, dependent girl he believed he had shaped. But while he whispered lies into my ear, I began speaking truth, quietly, carefully, back into my own mind. I went through every message, every note, every saved draft and voicemail in those phones. I pieced together versions of myself I had forgotten existed. There were audio memos of me crying, laughing, doubting, pleading for clarity. There were text chains with friends that ended abruptly, right when Elias had said they weren't good for me. There were screenshots of articles I had saved about gaslighting, memory manipulation, digital surveillance. It was like I had tried to leave a trail for myself. Breadcrumbs through the fog. And now, finally, I was following them. But I didn't confront him. Not yet. Because Elias was too skilled, too smooth. He would twist it. Weaponize my tone, my confusion, my fear. If I pushed too hard, he'd pull the strings tighter. He might even cut me off completely. Lock me down for real. So I did what I had never dared before. I lied to him. Beautifully. Effortlessly. It started small. I'm feeling better, I'd say with a soft smile. You were right. I just needed to rest. He beamed. Then, I don't know what I was thinking. My memory's always been a little fuzzy. You must be exhausted keeping up with me. He kissed my forehead. And finally, thank you for taking care of me. I don't know what I'd do without you. He wrapped his arms around me. And I let him. I leaned into his chest like I still needed him. Like the strings were still intact. But inside, I was severing them. One by one, I started to rebuild quietly. Covertly. First, I created a new email account on an old laptop I found in the storage unit, one Elias didn't know existed. I reconnected with Kara, using coded language, cautious words. I didn't tell her everything, but enough for her to know. I'm here. I'm waking up. I need time. She responded within minutes. I never stopped waiting for you. Then I bought a burner phone. Cash. No trail. I hid it beneath the floorboard under the bathroom sink, where Elias never went. I mapped his schedule carefully. He was predictable when he thought he was in control. Mornings were spent on video calls, always with his headphones in. Afternoons he napped or jogged. He had routines, rituals. I used them. I started documenting things, recordings, screenshots, timestamps of inconsistencies. Conversations where he contradicted himself. Voicemails where he coached me to say certain things in case anyone asked about our relationship. You have to make it sound convincing, he once whispered, voice low and warm in my ear. No one will understand what we have. I saved everything. I even began recording myself again, this time with clarity. I made short voice notes on the burner phone. Little affirmations. Reminders. You are not crazy. He is controlling you. This is not love. You remember who you were. Sometimes I cried while I said them. Not because I doubted them, but because it hurt how far I'd fallen from my own truth. But every day I grew stronger. Even if he didn't see it. Especially because he didn't see it. He still thought I was his little porcelain doll. Fragile. Helpless. Shaped in his image. But I had learned how to play dead with my eyes open. One afternoon, as he lay dozing on the couch, I opened the closet where he kept old files and books. I found a locked drawer at the bottom. It looked harmless, dusty, rarely used. But I had seen him open it once with a key on the chain he wore around his neck. He wasn't wearing the chain now. I moved quickly. The lock clicked open. Inside were folders, documents, transcripts, photos. Of me. Old journal entries. Screenshots of conversations I didn't remember having. Copies of my school transcripts. Medical records. Prescriptions I'd never taken. Fabricated letters from professors about mental health concerns. Drafts of emails I'd supposedly sent withdrawing from school. All of it was there. Proof that he hadn't just been gaslighting me. He had been constructing an entirely alternate version of my life. One where I was unstable. Where he was the hero. Where I needed him to protect me from myself. I stood there, shaking, fingers digging into the paper like they could tear through the lies. And I realized, he had built an escape-proof cage. One where no one would believe me. Not if I left. Not if I screamed. Not if I begged for help. Unless I had proof. So I took photos of everything. Every page. Every line. I uploaded them to a secure drive on a hidden cloud account. I emailed backups to Kara. I encrypted copies on a flash drive. I left everything in place, perfectly aligned, so he'd never suspect. Because he couldn't know yet. Not until I was ready. Not until I had everything. The last piece fell into place when I found the voice recordings, his, not mine, stored on a hidden folder within one of the phones. Conversations with someone named Marshall. Snippets about keeping her in check, controlling the narrative, ensuring she's legally dependent. I sat in the dark that night, listening to them over and over. And I didn't cry. Not this time. Because now the fear was gone, replaced by something deeper. Something sharper. Resolve. I wasn't just going to leave him. I was going to expose him. And every step I took from that moment forward was laced with fire. He didn't see it. He still kissed me goodnight like nothing had changed. Still called me my sweet girl. Still corrected my memories with a patient smile. But he didn't know I had begun to write a new ending. One where the marionette doesn't just cut the strings. She wraps them around the puppet master's throat. And pulls. Chapter 7, The Final Cut. The morning it happened, the sun was soft. It poured in through the windows like forgiveness, like a new beginning dressed in gold. Outside, the world moved as it always did. Unaware, unshaken, spinning toward a future I could finally see myself in again. Inside, Elias made eggs. Like nothing was wrong. Like the girl across the kitchen from him wasn't planning to destroy everything he had spent the past year constructing, thread by thread, lie by lie. I watched him stir the pan with casual elegance, the same way he used to smooth the chaos inside me. Methodical. Quiet. I had memorized every one of his movements by now. The way he cracked eggs with one hand. The way he tilted his head when listening. The way he smiled at me like I was something fragile enough to be kept on a shelf and admired, but never really known. Sleep okay? He asked, not looking up. Yes, I said. He smiled faintly, plated the eggs, and brought them to the table. Eat, love. You look pale. I sat. I lifted the fork. I smiled. I chewed. And in my pocket, The flash drive containing every piece of evidence was pressing into my thigh like a heartbeat. The day had been planned for weeks. Every move choreographed. Every risk accounted for. Kara had booked the hotel under a fake name. I had packed a bag over the course of 3 days. 2 items at a time, hidden inside the lining of my art portfolio case. Elias never noticed. He'd grown so confident, so comfortable. He believed I was his perfect creation. But I wasn't. Not anymore. Not since the day I found that drawer. Not since the day I remembered who I was. I waited until he went for his jog. Same time every day. 27 minutes of silence where he believed I was journaling, or meditating, or tending to the plants I no longer cared about. The moment the door clicked shut behind him, I moved. I pulled the burner phone from the vent in the bathroom. Texted Kara, "Go." I grabbed the flash drive. Slipped it into the envelope already addressed to the law firm Kara worked at. Then I opened the laptop Elias used for everything. Emails, scheduling, surveillance. I had found the passwords weeks ago, in an unencrypted file ironically labeled trust.docs. The arrogance of it. In less than 2 minutes, I'd uploaded copies of everything. The voice recordings, the falsified medical records, the altered journal entries, the email drafts he'd written under my name. I sent them all to 6 places, 3 people, 3 encrypted cloud backups. Then, I made one last upload. A video of me. Calm. Direct. Staring into the camera. If you're watching this, it means I got out. My voice was steady. It surprised me how steady. I've been emotionally manipulated, digitally surveilled, and psychologically dismantled by Elias Caldwell. This is me, documenting my truth. I listed the dates. The lies. The tactics. I looked into that camera and told the story in my own voice. Not the one he had molded for me, but the one I had buried and finally exhumed. Then I shut the laptop, left it open on the table, and taped a single note to the screen. I remember everything. It was time. I grabbed the portfolio case, slipped on the hoodie I hadn't worn since university, and walked out the door like I was going for coffee. But I didn't look back. Not even once. The first few hours were a blur. Kara met me at a gas station outside the city limits. We didn't hug right away. She just looked at me for a long time, tears in her eyes, like she didn't believe I was real. "Is it done?" she asked. "Not yet," I whispered. "But it started." We drove to the hotel in silence. I didn't cry. I didn't speak. My body ached with exhaustion, but my mind was electric. I watched my reflection in the window the way you watch a ghost learning how to walk again. I saw pieces of myself returning, slowly, like scattered stars reassembling into a constellation I used to know by heart. That night, I lay in a bed that wasn't Elias's. The sheets were stiff. The room smelled like cleaning solution and lavender. But I slept harder than I had in months. And when I woke up, I remembered the dream. I was standing in front of a mirror. But this time, the girl inside it wasn't silent. She looked straight at me and said, "You came back." The fallout came fast. By the time Elias returned to the apartment, the emails were already sent. The lawyers had already opened the files. The insurance fraud. The falsified psychiatric notes. The recordings. He called me 37 times in the first 24 hours. Left voicemails ranging from pleading to furious to eerily calm. "I don't know what you think you're doing," he said in one. "But none of it matters without context." I didn't respond. He emailed me a letter titled "Closure." I didn't open it. He texted me pictures of our first trip together. I blocked him. I filed for a protective order 3 days later. With the help of Kara's firm, I began the process of formally reporting everything, painstakingly documenting the psychological abuse, digital coercion, identity manipulation. It wasn't easy. It wasn't fast. But for the first time, the story was mine to tell. And he could no longer rewrite it. It's been 6 months. I live in a new city now. Smaller. Quieter. It doesn't buzz like the last one did, but it hums with something softer. Something kinder. I started painting again. Just abstracts for now. Colors that feel like healing. Textures that remind me I still exist in 3 dimensions. I found a new therapist. One I chose myself. One who doesn't ask leading questions. Who listens when I say I feel like I'm still crawling out of someone else's mind. Some days, I still hear his voice in the back of mine. I still wonder which memories were real. But most days, I'm stronger. Most days, I stand in front of the mirror and recognize the girl staring back at me. She's different now. Not because he broke her, but because she rebuilt herself, without strings. Without shame. Without him. If you're listening to this, If you've ever been made to doubt your memories, if you've ever shrunk to fit someone else's version of love, if you've ever asked yourself, am I the problem? Let me say this. You are not broken. You are just tangled. You were never the puppet. You were always the flame. And sometimes the final cut doesn't come with a scream. Sometimes it comes with silence, with stillness, with a girl stepping out of the dark, scissors in hand, and walking into the light she was never meant to forget.